Welcome to Hard Talk on the BBC World Service with me, Stephen Sacker. James Lovelock, one of the past century's most influential thinkers on environmentalism and natural science, died last week at the age of 103. Over the span of his long life, Lovelock didn't describe himself as a scientist. He always preferred to be described as an engineer or inventor, and that reflected his desire to focus on practical, real-world problems and how to solve them with unconventional thinking. He'll always be best remembered for one big idea, his Gaia hypothesis, which back in the 1970s had a radical impact on environmentalism. He encouraged us to see planet Earth, Gaia, as an integrated, self-regulating system with the fate of all forms of life and the planet itself connected and intertwined. From that idea, Lovelock developed a host of strong, often provocative opinions on what humans should do to best maintain Gaia's balance. In 2021, I visited him at his home by the sea in southern England to talk about those provocative ideas and his concerns about the future of humanity and our planet. This is another chance to hear that interview. James Lovelock, welcome to Hard Talk.
Thank you. Yes, glad to be back.
It is such a pleasure to have you back on the programme. I want to ask you for your reflections on your own famous Gaia hypothesis, that idea that all of life on this planet and the planet itself are part of one self-regulating system. When you developed the idea 5 decades ago, you seemed quite optimistic that this system was very durable, very resilient.
Well, it had lasted 3 billion years. That's not bad going.
But are you now worried about its vulnerability?
Yes, I am. You see, I see Gaia, the system of the Earth, as about the same age as me, in effect.
I don't mean
it's 102 coming up. What I mean is it's equivalent to that in the planet's terms. Its time is approaching.
You're saying that our planet and all of life on this planet is in its last phase?
Unless we do things to stop that happening, or those that follow us do it, it could be rescued to an extent.
What would we all, as a species, the human species, what would we all need to do now to avert that sort of, frankly, end-of-life scenario that you're talking about?
The first thing is to understand what's happening. You can't really do much if everybody's arguing about it, which they have been up to date. Very few people accepted my theory of the Earth at the beginning. The biologists in particular felt that it was in some ways anti-Darwin, which it wasn't in any way. It complied entirely in agreement with Darwin's great ideas. It took a long time before they swung round. And the trouble is, science is too divided up. Universities, for their own reasons, have separated it into a whole series of different subjects, so that physicists know damn all about biology, most of them, and biologists very little about physics or geology or anything else. They just stick with their own subject, and that's no way to understanding. And see, they've got to change it.
When I last spoke to you, which was more than a decade ago, I came away feeling that while you were anxious that we humans were not doing enough to address the challenge of climate change, that in the end, Gaia, the inclusive planet with all of life within it, was durable enough to withstand the mistakes being made by human beings. Now I'm sensing that you're not so sure.
Absolutely, because we've been doing so much damage on such a scale. You see, before we started interfering about, I suppose, 100 or more years ago, the planet was looking after itself pretty well, and it would have gone on for quite a long time. I had an article in the journal Nature on the lifespan of the biosphere, and It put it at about 1 million years at least. I believed that then, but gradually we've got worse and worse. We've put more and more greenhouse gas into the atmosphere, and we insist we need to do so. Nothing that is argued against it seems to have any effect on people at large. I think the trouble mainly is there's so much money tied up in it.
But we do now have governments around the world who are making real commitments, for example, to being net zero carbon emitters by 2050. That's a pledge made by the UK government, by other developed world governments. The Chinese government is pouring resources into renewables, now trying to cut its own emissions. Are you not looking around the world and feeling that finally the message is getting through?
Yes, so I think they're more worried about the money than they are about the climate. There's a kind of feeling that their pensions and things like that are threatened by changes in the use of different fuels. But there's plenty of hard evidence now, and there's no doubt about it, and that Paris conference was based on hard evidence, not on guesswork or anything like that. The government should be following the suggestions made there, but they don't. They get carried away with, well, it'll upset the city, so let's put it off a bit.
What are your feelings right now about all of us, your fellow human beings, and our ability not just to see what we're doing to our planet, but to act upon it, to change our behaviours? I mean, all of us, not just governments, but all of us. Are we as a species capable of taking the long-term strategic view and changing our behaviours?
I like to think we are. After all, when a war is threatened and it becomes a reality and they go to war, most people in the nation that's involved in it, regardless of what side they're on, think it's the right thing to do, and they've got to go along and support it. And what is needed is that kind of commitment on the part of the population to climate change. And that doesn't exist at the moment.
How urgent then, or maybe it's too late? I mean, I just wonder, in the past you've talked about a scenario in which 80% of human beings are basically killed off by this long-term warming of the planet, of Gaia. Is that still the way you see it?
I don't think they'll be killed off so much by the heat. I think that as the climate changes, so the plants that we're familiar with will no longer grow. Large areas will become desert and they won't be productive. And there's an awful lot of people in the world now. I've forgotten what the exact figure is, somewhere around about 7 or 8 billion, isn't it? And they need a lot of food. And what's happening to the climate more affects our food supplies, I think, than making it too hot for them to bear, because a lot of places won't be too hot.
You, though, have always been a great believer in human beings' ability to find solutions. You call yourself an engineer and an inventor rather than a scientist, and you've always championed huge human projects that might mitigate the effects of this climate change. You've talked about putting
geoengineering,
vast mirrors into the sky. You've talked about putting sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere to create a shield, in a sense.
And so have others, yes.
Do you still believe in geoengineering?
I think that one method or other will probably be used. The trouble is getting it global. I mean, it's all very well to say, as I often say, that we should be relying in Britain on nuclear energy and those renewables we can use, like putting windmills way out at sea, where the wind really blows most of the time, and it's quite a good source. But it's not popular because of the money side of it. Mm.
Well, to be honest with you, your great advocacy over many years of
of nuclear energy, nuclear power, hasn't been popular because many people, particularly in the Green movement, you've had some allies in the Green movement and you've had some enemies, but many in the environmental movement see nuclear power as a fundamentally dangerous option. They would point to everything from Chernobyl to, as you know, they would point to Fukushima in the more recent past in Japan, and they would say it is insane for human beings to rely on a source of power which, when it goes wrong, threatens the lives of millions.
What is much more insane is that when the word Fukushima is mentioned, most people everywhere now think of a nuclear accident that killed a vast number of people. And this is ridiculous. It was a tsunami, one of the worst tsunamis for a long time. It so happened that a nuclear power station was disabled by the tsunami, but that is all. Mm. It wasn't a nuclear accident.
You've described humanity's failure to really embrace nuclear power as a massive act of planetary self-harm.
Yes.
But you're not winning that argument. Have you conceded that you probably will never win it?
I'm not sure about that. I think that when the burning of fossil fuels really becomes untenable because it's doing so much damage and it's right shut down, they've got to get the energy from somewhere if we're to survive. And they'll have to look again at nuclear and start saying, oh, well, of course, it really hasn't killed many people, has it?
Mm. You have looked at the planet and the biosphere and the balance between human activity and the rest of organic life and the very planet itself. You've looked at it in many different ways. I'm intrigued to know what you make of the COVID pandemic and what lessons you take from that in terms of the health of Gaia right now. What is the COVID pandemic telling us?
I don't know, but I just hope that it's not telling us that as our population grows and becomes unsupportable, that natural evolution will produce more and more pandemics. After all, the COVID one is probably nowhere near as bad as the influenza one that came in 1918 before there were any vaccines to prevent it going. That was a really deadly one.
Again, I'm intrigued to tap into your long experience of different eras and different governments and political leaders. The generation of leaders we have today, do you see them as being capable of addressing the scale of the challenge, the environmental challenge that we all now face?
I think, let's put it this way, I'd like to think that they might be. The trouble is that they're advised by so many diverse sources right across the board with contrary stories about what should and shouldn't be done, that it can't be a very easy job to be a politician. I've met quite a few of them in my time, not only in this country, but in countries like Japan and elsewhere. And I don't envy their task. I know ambition leads them to it because it's a prestigious one, but it isn't an enviable one.
I want to ask you about artificial intelligence, because you wrote a book recently called Novocene, where you seem to suggest that machine learning is going to reach a point where we human beings are, frankly, superseded at the top of the sort of intelligence pyramid on planet Earth. What do you foresee happening?
Well, I've written it in the book.
Well, I know, but most people haven't read it.
Actually, I was driven to write that because I was, a long time ago, there was a Czech author called Karel Čapek, who wrote a book called Rossum's Universal Robots. And that was about 1920, I think he wrote that. It was just about the time I was born. And they're still talking about it in Hollywood, as if it was new, these cyborgs and things like that. I thought, oh, to hell with it. It won't be that kind of warlike, destructive thing, another tribe of people. if the robots really are worth talking about, let's have intelligent ones.
But we know that in labs across the world, artificial intelligence is now at the front and centre of research and development. But the question is, how far can it go? In the end, will machines have an autonomy, an independent consciousness, thinking capacity that will far surpass we humans?
No reason why not. And transcend ours enormously. And the main reason is quite simple, and anybody can understand it. The living stuff, the biological intelligences on the Earth, of all kinds, don't forget we're not the only ones. Whales have got enormous brains, so have elephants. Elephants have got a bigger brain than we've got. And there's evidence they use it. So we mustn't get too proud. But we are very limited because the speed at which a signal goes along a neuron is 1/1,000,000th as slow as the speed that an electron goes down a copper wire. And this gives the artificial intelligence an enormous advantage, a millionfold advantage. Once it starts working, it can be enormously simpler, and it is. And it can do things that we can't do.
Is your vision then that in the future of Gaia, this planet and all of its life, organic life coexists with electronic intelligent life?
Yes. It's an interesting mixture. It's rather like us coexisting with plants. We will operate at very different speeds, indeed. But we get on all right.
But we are vast consumers of resources. And as we've discussed in this interview, we also have managed to emit greenhouse gases, which have caused a dangerous warming of our planet. So if there is an intelligent machine-based life form of the future, they may regard humans as really rather useless and counterproductive.
It's not going to put up with burning coal.
No.
Or oil. It'll take, start using nuclear or else.
I think many years ago, were offered a trip to space by Richard Branson.
Yes.
What happened to that?
Oh, well, poor Richard Branson had bad luck with his plane. There was a crash with the space plane that he was going to put me on. And, I mean, that kind of thing happens in the development of new aircraft, but I think we've got a lot more fussy these days than we used to be.
It just intrigued me that you sounded quite keen to go.
I was.
Do you see human colonization of space as a vital part of our future as a species? Because Elon Musk, for example, and Jeff Bezos, they both seem to believe that, frankly, the future for human beings on Earth is very limited.
And I think they're crazy.
They're crazy?
On that issue, yes. And they're not crazy in what they've been doing commercially, obviously. I mean, Amazon is probably the most successful shop there's ever been.
Well, we'll leave aside his success with Amazon as a business, but when Bezos talks about the exciting future for the human species, far beyond our own planet.
He doesn't know much about it. I've spent a lot of time with NASA, Jet Propulsion Labs and elsewhere, with the people who are concerned with actually going there and sending stuff there. By there, I mean outer space. And they don't share, and neither do I share. Bezos' view. Mars is the most inhospitable place, if ever you... I, of all the crazy places to want to go to, that takes the biscuit. You'd be far happier on the middle of the Antarctic ice cap. At least you've got air to breathe. You haven't on Mars.
But you're a visionary thinker. Isn't it incumbent upon people like you to have big ideas about how we humans can overcome the reality, which is that ultimately the sun will get hotter and hotter and our planet, whatever we do, will ultimately become unlivable. That is in the long, long term, that's the reality we face. So shouldn't we humans be thinking about how to move beyond planet Earth?
No, our lifespan is just in the order of 100 years max. And compared with that, the Earth has got, we're talking millions of years. So there's no hurry whatever in normal circumstances. If the Earth were just proceeding as it was before humans appeared, it's what we're doing that's doing the damage, not anything else. The Earth naturally would go through its warm periods and ice ages and things like that for a good long time yet. We're talking millions of years probably.
So your message would be we need to absolutely focus on what we do on this planet rather than spend too much time wondering about where else we might travel to.
We'd never get there because we'll have destroyed our base.
Now you, again, in our conversation, have mentioned your own age several times, and it's fantastic to be able to talk to you when you're about to celebrate your 102nd birthday. I just wonder whether your own mortality colours your thoughts these days. You know, you've described how being 100 has made you feel wonderful. How do you cope with thoughts of mortality?
One of the strangest things was that before I reached 100, I was always kind of slightly depressed about the thought. When I'm past that, well, I'm on the dust heap. Finished.
Well, if this is a dust heap, it's certainly a very lovely one.
The reality was so much better. It's been a period of considerable happiness. I don't know where I'm taking Sandy's.
Well, you're looking at your wife who's sitting off camera.
It's been a period of greater happiness, not less. Mm. And I pass that on to others who are in the same queue that I'm in. I'm well aware that either of us might get taken at some time in the near, not too distant future, but, well, that's...
And in the meantime, you appear to be intent on still thinking, writing, having big thoughts about us all and this planet we live on.
Yes, very much so.
With a smile on your face, despite everything we've discussed.
Of course. I think we'll get by all right.
James Lovelock, it has been a pleasure having you on Hard Talk again.
And thank you for a very sensible and lively lot of questions.
That was the pioneering environmental scientist and writer, James Lovelock, who died last week at the age of 103, speaking to Stephen Sacker on Hard Talk in July 2021.
I was trying to understand why my friend from school time and other friends from our city were becoming jihadis. She was in Syria.
6 months pregnant, you travelled to Syria in order to make a film about this friend of yours.
Just a personal documentary about her radicalization.
This is Lives Less Ordinary. Remarkable personal stories from across the globe.
She was part of a group which was connected to Al-Qaeda. I was not feeling insecure because I had a security guarantee from my friend and the group she was associated with.
Lives Less Ordinary, from the BBC World Service.
I was not sure at the beginning if they were kidnapping me for political reasons, if they were kidnapping me for money. The whole situation was for me totally unclear.
Search for Lives Less Ordinary wherever you get your podcasts.